This is Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
JBL Tour Pro 3 earbuds are for those who don't conform to the standard.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to get into some touchscreen technology, how about the smart charging case, clear sound? These are not standard things. You're only going to get them with the JBL Tour Pro 3, baby.
And I love the sound of JBL when it goes, boom, boom. These earbuds are packed with innovation because you can't stand out by following others.
Touchscreen smart charging case for one-touch control, instant EQ customization, true adaptive noise canceling, and the one-of-a-kind audio transmitter, which can plug and play with everything from game consoles to in-flight entertainment. What more could you want? First doesn't follow. Grab a pair at JBL.com.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, visiting with Professor Sean McMeekin. The new book is To Overthrow the World, The Rise and Fall and Rise of Communism. We spent our time in the 19th century with Karl Marx and his antecedents. Now the man himself, Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov, the son of school teachers, principals, a man who has a very colorful 54 years, I believe, born in 1870, died in 1924 after a series of strokes. How did he come to be a Marxist? What is it that compelled him? Probably the family story, but also the Communist Manifesto and Das Kapital were published in Russian and were very large successes, especially Das Kapital. The manifesto I have, Karl Marx, Vladimir Lenin. He calls himself Lenin. His name is Ulyanov, but he takes up a nom de guerre during his publishing of something called the Iskra, the spark. He reads it for the first time and adopts it in 89. What about the manifesto that appealed to him? Was it the leveling? Was it the transformation of all that is into something new? Did he have some magical connection to it, Professor?
Well, I think Lenin was certainly inspired by the overall vision, the radicalism of it, but particularly I think the aspect of it which did require political violence, something that Lenin was always quite adamant about advocating himself. To the extent Lenin updated Marx's ideas, and one can see that as early as Studielet or What is to be Done, published in 1902, which was really a manual of revolutionary tactics, sometimes called vanguardism, Lenin's idea that you had this top-down party that, because the workers weren't really doing it themselves or figuring out the doctrine, you had to have these professional revolutionaries, these intellectuals, these cadres who do it for them. Lenin's other, I think, real innovation came during the First World War. But again, it was partly from his study of not just Marx's works, but also Marx's life and his example. For example, the Franco-Prussian War and the Paris Commune, which we talked about, Lenin drew from this the idea that if two countries went to war, perhaps more than two, that war, the cataclysm, but also particularly the possibility that one side would have to lose and that side would be discredited, its regime, its whole ruling classes would be discredited. That would create the opportunity for revolutions, such as happened with the French in the Paris Commune. And he saw this happen again in Russia during the Russo-Japanese War of 1904-1905, which produced a kind of political revolution in Russia, although it didn't go as far as he would have liked. So during the First World War, he worked this out and he called the idea of revolutionary defeatism, which actually went beyond simply this idea that you could use the war and the loss of one country in that war as a springboard to revolution, or as the phrase went, turn the imperialist war into civil war. Lenin actually outlined this quite explicitly in a work called the Military Program of the Proletarian Revolution. And what Lenin foresaw, and here's where you can see, I think, where he really was inspired by the violent nature of Marx's vision, that Lenin thought, following Marx, that this cataclysm, the imperialist war, as he called the First World War, would produce basically a revolution, whatever the weakest link in the chain was, which he hoped would be Russia, that Russia would lose and that's where the revolution would start. But that's not where it would end. The imperialist war would first turn into a civil war in Russia, and then once the communists took power there, they would then be in a state of kind of undeclared or perhaps declared war with the rest of the world, with the outside world, the capitalist world. So that in the end, the imperialist war would beget a civil war, which in turn would beget a whole series of wars between that new proletarian dictatorship or communist country and all the non-communist countries. So you'd have this state of perennial global civil war, and you'd have a whole kind of series of civil wars erupting all over the world until you would finally usher in the great proletarian revolution. So that he was taking Marx's ideas in the same direction, but a little bit further. And to the extent I think he understood something, maybe Marx hadn't quite understood in Das Kapital that in the end, the more likely catalyst for communist revolution was actually war between the capitalist powers, between the capitalist states. This was also what he called imperialism as the highest stage of capitalism, that the cataclysm, when the integument of private property would supposedly burst asunder, that what would actually happen was you'd get a kind of global imperialist war. This war would then beget more wars, civil wars, basically ad nauseum, until the whole world would be engulfed in this kind of flame of revolutionary violence and civil war. And mind you, he was not saying that he hoped this wouldn't happen. He was saying this is exactly what he wanted to happen. He was advocating this as a kind of ideal scenario, that the world would erupt in a series of ever bloodier, ever more cataclysmic civil wars. And this is how the communists would come to power.
There are other voices. Some call themselves a socialist. Some call themselves Menshevik, some call themselves anarchist. And there's another theory of the transformation of the bourgeois, the middle class, of what exists, the status quo, into the future, and that is immiseration. There seems to be a tension, Professor, between revolutionary defeatism and immiseration. How was that resolved?
Well, so the immiseration thesis, or Verelendung, as the German word had it, this was Marx's idea, expressed most, I suppose, thoroughly in Das Kapital, that all of the workers everywhere in the world, maybe they didn't start off as industrial proletarians, they might have been in other classes or professions or artisans, eventually they would all be kind of melted together into this universal proletarian class, ever more miserable, ever poor, that wages would keep declining according to a version of Ricardo's own iron law of wages, though Marx didn't actually attribute it to Ricardo, but it was a similar idea, but he'd taken an even more extreme direction, and that eventually everyone would be equally poor and miserable until, I suppose, some magical moment would happen and the communists or the proletarians would rise up and overthrow the classes. The anarchists had a very different idea. It wasn't nearly as systematic. It was more that they would just strike these symbolic blows here and there, acts of rebellion or political violence or political assassination or perhaps kind of theft or wildcat strikes. They never really quite worked out what the future society would look like. They were just skeptical about the Marxist vision, as Bakunin, one of Marx's rivals, a Russian anarchist, had pointed out, and I think he was quite prophetic about this. In the end, if you wanted to have state control of the economy, abolition of private property, and state control of all economic activity, that would require, of course, an infinitely powerful state, a kind of state tyranny. And the anarchists didn't like that. They weren't quite sure what would replace it. There were a lot of other socialists, I suppose, who wanted to kind of have their cake and eat it too. They wanted to have some variety of a greater government role in the economy, some variety of a larger voice for the workers in elections, in parliament, in organizing a political system, but they didn't want to necessarily embrace the political violence. And so you might say they lacked the courage of their convictions in the way that the Bolsheviks did, whether it was the Mensheviks in Russia or some of the Social Democrats in Europe, who in the end rejected communism. Believe it or not, they actually had their own organization in the interwar years in the 20s and 30s, referred to in shorthand as, whereas Lenin's was the Third International, following the first under Marx, the second which had blown up in 1914 at the outbreak of the First World War. Theirs was the Second and a Half International. It was kind of, they did believe in solidarity, but they shied away from the violence and from the more extreme vision of the communists, that is, in not just kind of directing violence domestically, but also in preparing for a global revolutionary cataclysm. So a lot of socialists shied away from that aspect of the communist project.
The professor's book allows us to concentrate on the ideas, the conversations, the dialogue, the debates, the arguments, the anger, and not just on the individual personalities. Although they're compelling, they come to the brutes and the mass murderers and the victims. But the ideas pass from generation to generation. Marx is an older generation who only knows his Prussian background. Ulyanov, Lenin, is a newer generation who understands provincial Russia and understands Russia entirely. But he travels in Europe. And I'm struck by his travels and what he learned from traveling in Europe. He was in Krakow. And it just so happens I've been in Krakow a couple of times in my life. It has a wonderful university. It's a very cultured city. It was never destroyed in the wars of the 20th century. Did he learn from the societies he lived in exile? Or was he indifferent? Did he close the door and shut his ears?
I think Lennon mostly shut his ears. He might have picked up a bit of a Germanic sensibility because he spent so much time among German speakers. I certainly don't think he picked up any of the ethereal beauty of Krakow. I mean, one of the things Lennon allegedly said was when he was younger and perhaps a little bit less devoted to his political project, his political vision, he used to listen to music and pay more attention to the world around him. But eventually he had to stop listening to music because it would just make him sentimental. It would want to make him pet, I think, the heads of small animals and small children. No, in the end, I think he was just beset and bedeviled by this political vision. One would certainly hope that he had been more, I think, influenced by the world around him. But I think in the end, it was really mostly his books and his tracks and his ideas that drove him.
We move to two lieutenants of Vladimir Lenin, Ulyanov. You know them both as killers. But they're also thinkers, especially Stalin, who had an enormous library and was proud of it. The book is To Overthrow the World, The Rise and Fall and Rise of Communism. Sean McMeekin is the author. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
Truth is, Ohio, when it comes to broccoli salad, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. You know it, your neighbors know it, heck, everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows it. That tangy zip of Miracle Whip is the reason why Ohio's broccoli salad runs circles around everybody else's and never gets winded. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip right where it belongs in all your favorite recipes. Buy Miracle Whip at your local grocery store and get your tang on, Ohio.
Hey, Ryan Reynolds here. Wishing you a very happy half-off holiday because right now Mint Mobile is offering you the gift of 50% off unlimited. To be clear, that's half price, not half the service. And Mint is still premium unlimited wireless for a great price. So that means a half day, yeah? Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3 month plan equivalent to $15 per month required. New customer offer for first 3 months only. Speeds low after 35 gigabytes of networks busy. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.